I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Today on What's Next, we are in Jamestown, New York, at Jamestown Community College, as a matter of fact, and we're talking with Reed Helford. Reed is the coordinator of the prison education program at Jamestown Community College. Reed, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Of course, when we're talking about prison education, we're not necessarily talking about what you do necessarily specifically right here at the college, right?
Right.
Also at Collins Correctional Facility, correct?
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. Talk to me. You came here for that program because I know your background has you, you kind of found your way into teaching in prisons
right.
out in Washington State.
Right.
So that's why you came here?
So no, I came here to care for a family member to this area and had been here 3 or 4 years until this position came open.
Oh.
And have been here now about 8 months. And it's my passion. This work is my passion. So I'm very lucky to find something so close to where I live.
Right. And so, just to be clear, then when you were in we took you to Bradford, obviously, you were talking about your family member.
Right.
So you weren't teaching in the prison, in any other prison until this came around.
Yeah, so I had taught years before. So I had started my career at Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla. I was asked to teach part-time a college course, and I was blown over by the experience.
Yeah.
It was tough at first, to be honest, but did really well. Learned and found that experience so much more fulfilling than my previous college teaching experience to folks in the free world. And so I was asked to take over the solitary confinement education program. And that was another very big challenge to my abilities as a teacher. And so in that situation, I would carry a whiteboard in front of this small 4-inch by 12-inch window on their steel doors, and I would teach through that window. And write on the little whiteboard to those men.
And could they communicate with you?
They could talk through the door.
They could talk through the door.
We eventually built a classroom, one of the first in the United States in solitary confinement. And so we eventually began to use a classroom for teaching, which again, Washington State at the time was very progressive in their approach. And so that was a huge advantage for the program. We began to teach pre-college classes beyond just ABE and GED kind of classes, adult education. We started teaching pre-college, doing cognitive behavioral programs, all kinds of things that we could do in solitary, where a lot of the men really wanted to get out of their cells. You're in 23 hours a day, and this allowed them several hours a day more to be out of their cells. And so it was unusual. The men were chained to their chairs, to be honest. That took some getting used to. But I think once we all adjusted to the seeming awkwardness of that classroom, it became a really powerful place to teach.
We got a lot to explore here, and I'm very curious about that. But just how about the first time just walking into the prison to teach? What are you talking about?
I think it's terrifying at first. You don't know what to expect. You just have stereotypes of what these men will be like. And you go through some of the same search and metal detector and the things that these men have gone through, and so it's a little bit scary at first. You're concerned to do the right thing and to be careful. Once you're in the classroom, it's just like a classroom. It's just like anywhere else. Once you get past that initial part, most cases an officer's not in the classroom with you, so you're alone with those men. And I think I wasn't concerned about what the men might do to me. I was concerned about how they'd respond to what I was teaching. And my first classes were sociology classes in the prison. And after a couple of weeks of getting to know each other and building that trust with them, where they felt they could be vulnerable and speak up in class, it was like floodgates opened. And they challenged me in ways that I'd not been challenged in the classroom before.
Challenged? How so?
They don't necessarily believe what you're selling, to be honest.
Okay.
They're like, sociologists think this. Well, this is my experience. And they'd push back, and their experiences are varied. and different than mine. And so as a teacher, you'd have to step back and be open to your expertise has boundaries in those classrooms. So you are the expert. They recognize, they call you Dr. H or Dr. Helford, but they also feel like they have a right to challenge the material in a way that my students in the free world didn't do as much. And so they're good students in that way. They're not traditionally good students the way we think, quiet, listen, ask appropriate questions. There were folks who would ask really hard questions, challenge the way sociology talked about gender, challenge the way sociology talked about race, challenge the way sociology represented their experiences. I taught juvenile justice, was the first one of the first classes I taught. And they'd say, well, my experience was this. Why are you saying it's this? And we talk about multiple perspectives. And they learn that their perspective was valuable, but just one of many perspectives. And I think that was really helpful for them as they began to see the world a lot bigger than just their experience. But as a teacher, guiding them really slowly along that path instead of denying the value of their experience.
It sounds like it's a way for you. I mean, you must have learned so much then, right? I mean, yeah. All of a sudden you're opening up your knowledge and expertise to viewpoints maybe you didn't necessarily understand.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can read a lot of criminology, and I'm teaching a criminology class right now in Collins, and they're hungry for that. They want to understand the way and why sociologists think people commit crime and how they're thought of in the discipline. And so you'd think that would be hard to listen to, but they're really open to it and they want to understand it. And they'll search and find the theory that makes sense to them given their experience. Like, huh, I experienced this in my community. There's a theory here you're talking about that fits my experience. And it's powerful to have a way of talking about yourself that isn't just blaming you, but putting it in context, that this is how the culture or the society works, and this is perhaps why I went down this path. Right. And it can be really powerful for the men involved.
So it implies then that some of these men were teaching their experiences to you, or they were sharing those experiences?
To a certain extent. I mean, there are some limits and some rules in prison about not particularly talking about your crime.
Okay.
But they do talk a lot about their experience, whether it's traumatic experiences they've had, or living in really disorganized or troubled communities, or in absolute poverty, or with parents who were involved in criminal activities that they were brought up with. And so they have a sensitivity to the truth in what I bring to the classroom is in terms of their life experience. And when it doesn't seem to ring right with them, we share it in class and say, well, who else does this theory feel right to? And there's always someone that says, you know what, this makes sense to me. And the other guys will listen. And so as a group, we kind of begin to have an understanding again that their perspective is important and it's valuable, but it's not the only perspective. And then we have these shared perspectives, including the perspective of the officers in the prison who have opinions and beliefs too about these things. And so to begin to see the officers in the context of their lives and in the culture, as opposed to just saying they're mean to me, they do this to me, they understand, oh, this is the system they're in. This is perhaps why they make the choices that I don't like. And I think that's really powerful. It doesn't mean that they excuse those things and don't want to perhaps challenge some of those experiences, but they can understand them in a context and make more sense of them without quickly judging and dismissing.
I'm curious about how just family members, friends, when you tell them about your experience. I mean, I'm sure right off the bat that you probably see eyes wide open right
off
the bat.
Yeah, I mean, it's both good and bad. So a lot of folks will go right to what they've seen in the movies or on TV. And they're like, oh my God, you must be under threat. Did someone stab you with a sharpened toothbrush, you know, for giving them a C in class? I'm like, no, those things don't happen.
Right.
We're concerned about safety and security, and we're reminded of that all the time in the prison. But it's just a place it's hard to teach, not because of any threats that these men represent. It's hard to teach because you're in an institution that isn't designed, perhaps, for education the way most of us know it. But yeah, most people are like, do you work with these serial killers? Do you work with these guys? They want to know what their crimes are. The longer you work in prison, the less you really care about what their crimes are. You care about where they're headed, where they're going, and who they're going to be when they get out. So we don't just teach for that moment. We're thinking long term, where are these men headed? Because all of them that are in our classroom are getting out in the next 2 to 4 years. And so what can we do so that we can make the likelihood of them never coming back even greater? And so it's always part of what you're teaching. You're thinking long term for them. You're thinking about the identities they're taking on that they're going to take to the streets. And so when people want to talk about that, we have a name for it, but that prison sensationalism,
right.
It's not really helpful, and I disabuse people of that pretty quickly.
Sure.
Yeah. But there's some folks who like to talk about how heroic we are, walking through the barbed wire and the doors closed behind us, how brave we must be. And I'm like, yeah, at first it takes a little
right.
fortitude, but in the long run, it's you're just a teacher and you're in a classroom. We don't have much in the classroom. We have a blackboard or a whiteboard, and that's it. No other access to audiovisual stuff at all. So it takes good teaching. You have to really figure out how, just through lecture and handing out papers and reading together, how you're going to accomplish what you want. But it's not scary once you're in that classroom.
Do you see, I'm going to pull back on the use of the word growth.
Yeah.
But an evolution in your students as you're going through this?
Yeah. I mean, I think you have to be aware of it. And each of us are different depending on the discipline you're teaching. In my case, my hope is that they begin to think sociologically instead of in other ways, so that they think about structure and stuff. So the growth there is, can you explain and have understanding without judgment and without relying on personal attack or the individual? How are we going to look at the group? So when this happens in the world, how do we understand it as a group of people experiencing the same thing? How do we explain it? So you see, that's growth. They start letting go of some of their personal stories as the only way to explain the world, and they start thinking, huh, we could step back a little bit and see structure and see how I fit within the structure of the criminal justice system or in how my family life went or economically. There's this growth in that way, and that's a lot of fun to see as a sociologist. I think English teachers talk about them coming already with great skills and understanding because they've read so much in prison that they understand what good writing is, and that when they're given the chance to express themselves and write about their experience, it's exciting for them. And they watch that growth as they get more and more confident in their voice in that way.
So you're seeing quality writing?
I'm seeing quality writing. I think our English professor, Mr. B, Professor Brantingham, he talks a lot about how incredible the writing is. And so we're thinking about creating a writing group outside of the classroom to give them access. There's a lot of places they can publish their work, particularly the work of incarcerated men. And so he's encouraging that. And some of them have created some amazing things. And it's not that I'm surprised, but there are times when I'm like, wow.
Right.
Like, where has this person been? Where it's unfortunate that voice has had to go through this to finally see the world and for people to hear that. And so I have a student right now that's in my social class that's trying to figure out what his identity is going to be in the streets. He's in his fourth bid, his fourth time in prison, and he's done. And he's going to move out of the area when he releases because he can't be around old friends and places. And we did a section on convict criminology, which came in sociology probably about 20 years ago, where men and women who are formerly incarcerated have obtained their PhD in sociology and are now criminologists themselves. And they say their perspective is of great value to the discipline. And they challenge a lot on the discipline based on their experience of being in the system and being so impacted by the system. And he got so excited about the concept of convict criminology. He calls himself that now. And so his goal is to do that when he gets out.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. You get emotional about it because you see someone whose life was really difficult, who's like, I could be this thing. Yeah.
We're talking with Reed Helfer today, or Reed Helford, I should say, at Jamestown Community College, and we're talking about the prison education program at Genesee Community College, and of course, we're talking about actually your work over at Collins Correctional Facility. Are there students here who are taking courses to be able to, I mean, I guess, what's the connection between what you're doing there and Jamestown Community College?
I think it just fulfills our mission to provide access to education for anyone in our community that wants that.
Right.
And so they're part of our broader community, and so they deserve that opportunity. We're thinking long-term, how do we integrate it more into campus?
We're not there yet?
Not there yet. The program's just finishing its first year. And so right now we're growing the program. It's now has an identity within the prison, so we're having a lot of men reaching out wanting to be in the program. And so we're growing, we're attracting more faculty that want to teach in the program. And so long term, we've thought, can we do an inside out class? if the prison is open to it, where students actually would take classes alongside these men in the prison. That's a long time, maybe in the future, but something I did in Washington State that was really successful.
I was going to say, there, I would think there would be extraordinary value in that.
Yeah, it's amazing. And the students, both sides, both the incarcerated students and the free students, really, really experience. I mean, some of them consider it life-changing. And I've had people write me still, send me emails from Washington State that went through that experience as students that went into the prison to learn, and they still think about the guys in there. They think about how it changed their assumptions about what a student should have and their sense of privilege, that they never recognize the things that they have. And so, yeah, it's a great way to learn, and for the men on the inside to feel like a student. We talked before about identity. It's one of the most important things when these men get out, is not just stopping committing crime, but taking on an identity, some people call it a pro-social identity, an identity that is not criminal anymore. And then the next step is, can others recognize them as part of this community of people that, convict criminologist, a good parent, a student, an intellectual, we talk a lot about that. You have to care about ideas to be in this program. And people that care about ideas, we call them intellectuals. And for some of the men to think of themselves as an intellectual is a really important thing. And so we support that. We want them to begin to take on identities and roles that were on the streets will be much more helpful for them than some of the criminal things that they get involved in.
You've been at Collins now, you said, what, 8 months?
So I've been here in the program for 8 months. The right. Program's finishing its first year.
What about some of your students back in Washington State? Have you been able to be in touch with any of them?
Sure. Yeah, many of them. I'm still in touch with a few who are still incarcerated.
Okay.
And they are... They, after going through the program, and some of them finished their associate's degree, some of them are finishing their four-year degrees with other programs. They reach out to me because they're sort of activists now for education, for things within the prison, and so oftentimes they invite me all the way to Washington State to come to an event that they're having. And so I try to honor that because, I let them know I'm in it for long term with you guys.
Right.
I've had others, to be honest, reach out to me from Washington that said, I got my AA degree, but I still can't get the jobs that I want. I'm still, my felony record is preventing me from doing the things I want, from living where I want. And so it's important to recognize that the degree is, I think, a critical part of their success on the outside, but it's not everything. They need to have stable housing. They need to have some kind of job that allows them to be relatively stable economically. And they need to begin to find connections in the community, like social capital, to people and to places and things that will allow them to succeed. And that's tough. That's really difficult. And so we can't pretend like that doesn't happen. It's why SUNY's Office of Higher Education in Prison is committed to developing a reentry sort of program where men can be directed to the resources they need when they get out, alongside the help of DOCCS to do that.
When you brought that up, it just sparked something that from a more recent conversation that we had on this program, just the concept and the need for people who are leaving prison
yep.
to have opportunities to get into.
I
mean, it almost, if you cannot find a job with some relative degree of satisfaction mm-hmm. and compensation,
yep.
that you're almost, I don't want to say doomed, I don't want to be that pessimistic, but I would have to think it's going to be very difficult.
It's going to be tough. And so that's a really important thing to figure out. And there are some men, given the nature of their crime, that will be really, really difficult. And so it's not something that we here at Jamestown Community College can solve, but we have to be part of that process. We
right.
can't pretend that just giving that credits and credentials is going to be all they need.
But do you know, is there that understanding, or is there an emerging understanding in the prison system? I know I'm asking you to speak for other people, but I'm sure you're
no,
that who are believe in just that very concept.
Yeah, absolutely they do. They talk about it all the time. And they do have transitional programming for men before they leave to do that. Everything from learning how to interview and create a resume, which we're also going to do for them as part of our career services. So the things we offer here on campus, we want to and we will offer inside as well. So our career services is very invested in this process. And so, yeah, the thing that's difficult is, can you convince many employers that that scarlet letter of that felony, is that something they can overlook or find a way to accommodate? And for many men, they do succeed that way, and they learn a skill, and they have credentials that allow them to go into certain fields. But others struggle. And so that's a difficult thing that we all have to be invested in. And so I think a lot of programming in prison now whether it's religious programming or education or whatever sort of programming there is, we all have a shared commitment that long term we have to provide things on the outside, at least be a piece of that solution. And that's going to be hard work that we have ahead of us. Yeah. And it's something we've talked about and people have talked about for years. But I think it's coming now to the point where you're going to have all these men achieving degrees inside with the new Pell Grants that are available. And now we've got to band together and figure out how we're going to connect these folks to the social services and the employment resources they need before.
And not to break it down into brass tacks, but do you see a legitimate dollars and cents or cost benefit relationship here? That this, the idea that this person is probably, if this person can stay on this path, they're not coming back to prison.
Yeah.
You're not going to have to hire guards and not have to have bars.
Think of the cost, not just the yearly cost to house someone in prison, but the process of getting them into prison and the trial and the detention in county and stuff. There are hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on these individuals just to get them back into prison. And so, yeah, it is to all of our benefit that we reduce that recidivism. And we think about it both ways, reducing recidivism, meaning they're not going back to prison, but also helping them to desist from crime, which means working on the internal stuff too, their sense of self, their identity, where they're going, the cultural capital and the way they speak, the way they learn how to present themselves, their credentials, all these things have to be put together for them because they do have to get over this hump of this felony record, which is really, really difficult.
Back to maybe some of the, you know, there's a lot of stories and some probably like to keep personal and a lot of, for good reason, I would think. But can you share, again, maybe some stories of some of your students, you know, just how, what you saw, what maybe they shared with you that, you know, I mean, I can only imagine that there are thousands of stories that you had.
Sure. I mean, some of the stories have a similar theme, which is a tension while they're in prison between who and what they can associate with. Again, I keep going back to this idea of identity. There are a lot of things you can do in prison. In Collins, it's not quite the same as what I experienced in Washington State, where gangs and racial distinctions were really important. It's not as important in Collins. I have a very diverse classroom, which I probably wouldn't have had quite on the West Coast. But when I worked with those men in Washington, there were tensions between, can I be a student in your college program and still maintain my identity with my gang, or the car, as we call it, that I'm part of? And I'm like, look, you got to be part of our gang. You know, we make a joke about it. But the truth is, those are really important decisions they have to make. And a lot of those men negotiated that very well, and others didn't, and were told not to participate in the program because they had an allegiance to this other group. Other folks, it's about belief in self, because many of them, their traumas started in school. Their path to prison started in school. And so now they have to trust that we're going to do this program and we're going to help them through. And many of them don't have the traditional skills you'd expect of a college student. So I've had men who will quietly, privately, when I had an office in Washington State, would come to me and say, look, I'm terrified. I don't know how to do this. I sit in class and I keep a good front, but I'm terrified as a student. I don't think I can do this. And so we would work and meet every week. How did you get through this week? Let's look at your homework. How did you feel today in class? Did you speak up? Like, begin to give them the confidence and the competence to get through a class, because being a student is never something that they did well, and they were punished for how they did it.
I'm wondering, though, at the same time, though, there's that other part where now I'm an adult going into these classes that I used to blow off when I was a teenager. And maybe just do you also see that adult learner who is focused and, you know, is really invested in what's going on and picks things up maybe better, a lot better than, again, a younger student might.
I can speak to a specific example, a very recent one, of a 50-year-old man who had done decades in prison. And he was in his last year or two, last year actually, and he took a semester or two with us. And at first it was hard, because he would come to me and say, look, Dr. H, I'm old. I haven't done this in 30, 40 years. I don't know if I can do it. And I'm like, yeah, you're still younger than me. You could do this. And so I think our teachers are understanding of that. We wouldn't have a professor in our program that didn't recognize that each of these men carry with them some concerns about their ability to succeed. And the age one comes up fairly often for us, because we have men in their 40s and 50s. And He struggled for his first semester. He did okay. And then his second semester, he blossomed. And now he's at Rochester on the streets.
Really?
Yeah.
And so this is a person from?
From Collins.
From Collins.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah, I just got an email from Rochester saying, hey, send us his transcript because he's enrolling here. And I'm like, great. I don't think I could have gotten into that school when I was
U of R, are you talking about?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. No, I could not get into U of R.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so, and they have someone, again, this is part of the whole process. They have someone specifically for reentry that's coming from prison who's committed to his case as a, as an advisor and counselor.
Sure.
And so that person is right on his and knows that now he had the anxiety for his first semester in prison. Think about it now when he's going with the 20-something-year-old kids, 19-year-old kids, who express themselves in ways and have vocabulary that's perhaps different than his.
Right.
How is he going to have the confidence? And so he has that person that's on his side to help him through that.
Is it a one-on-one relationship with this person? I mean, is that the only
he
person?
Meets with a, no, they have a couple folks.
Okay, all right.
Yeah,
I got
so
you.
The yeah, Rochester has a whole program, both in the prisons and when they return.
So I know it's the University of Rochester, but can you speak to their, you know, why they see a value in this opportunity?
I think
it's a great.
There's a commitment to it. I mean, I think there's
a commitment to humanity,
a moral
and
commitment
education.
To it. Yeah,
but that's still a lot for a large. I mean, U of R is an exceptional institution.
They have an educational justice initiative, or a it's REGI, REGJI, uh-huh. Rochester Educational Justice Initiative.
Okay,
I believe, and so they have a very full program both in the prisons and then when people release, and that's. I think long-term what we have to build in the schools. And so we don't have very many. Many of the men we have in Collins won't be returning to this area. We did have one student who was returning to New York City, to Long Island, but he said, I feel a little scared to jump in. Can I take online courses with you as a transition from my prison to then going full-time in person at school? And so he's taking classes online with us right now. And we have our success navigators, we call them, that assist these students. And they're working with him, and his transition has been really smooth, and he's doing really well. And so we have to take that on ourselves and be prepared for folks returning, because, like I said, with the renewal of Pell Grants, there's going to be thousands of men in this state that are returning to our colleges in the area. And so while we won't have a lot, perhaps, in Jamestown, we're ready for them.
Okay. Well, that's most certainly encouraging news. We are talking with Reed Helford. He is the coordinator of the prison education program at Jamestown Community College, teaching at Collins Correctional Facility. Collins is what, a medium?
Medium security.
Medium
yeah.
security?
Yeah.
And you said that in Walla Walla was
Every custody level.
Every custody level,
every
one
custody
place.
Level. Yeah, it's a very large, sprawling complex with new buildings and some of the oldest buildings in the state. So that was minimum, medium. Max, what we called max custody, or close custody would be the next one. So there was four levels plus special housing for men who couldn't live in the general population because of their crimes or their behavior.
So you've got a lot of experience now with the
over a decade
system.
Yeah,
and I'm sure you've talked to a lot of people on a lot of different levels. I'm curious about if there is a sense inside the prison system, and we kind of touched on this before, but is there a sense that this dynamic, the way it has been for just how many years, we can talk about decades, generations, centuries,
right?
Needs to change. That this system as it has been is not getting us the results that we want.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you look at recidivism rates alone, and I believe the latest one I read, the 10-year rate was over 80% are rearrested within 10 years, and over 60% are back in prison or jail. Something's not working.
Okay.
And so I think each of us will talk about it differently. So the DOCCS may talk about it differently than I might as someone outside the system.
I can appreciate that for sure.
But I think we're all committed to figuring this out and finding a way to reduce the number of men that go back. And so that prison, men leave prison better off than when they came. And there's a lot to be traumatized from in prison. Prison can be a traumatic experience. And so if you don't offer these other opportunities and you're not attentive to the mental health needs and the other needs, it becomes difficult just to even maintain the prison because the men need that ongoing as well as when they hit the streets. And so I think there is an understanding that we could do things better, and I think each of us has a role to play in that, but we'll talk about it differently depending on what we have to offer and where we are in the system.
Right. I can certainly appreciate that, but also I can appreciate hearing from somebody who's been inside and has seen transformational moments with with people. And I think, you know, there's obviously in New York State, a lot of change in recent years in terms of bail reform, also in terms of solitary confinement, which I know is a sticking point with, if I'm not mistaken, with the Corrections Officers Union.
It is.
Again, are all the stakeholders on board with the concept that this can be changed and changed for the better?
I think so. And I'll give you an example from Collins. I think when the prison program first started, before I even arrived, their first semester, I think there were some misunderstandings of what it is, and some understandings, do these men deserve it? Will this be safe? There was a lot of questions. And then when I came this past summer, I sat with the deputy superintendent of programs and the education supervisor, and we have an understanding. Like, we've grown together to make sense of what do we need to make this work. Why is this of value here? The fact that I'm teaching a criminology class, which in many prisons would not be allowed, and she sat and reviewed my book very carefully. The deputy superintendent looked very carefully to make sure this seemed safe, and she made the decision this is best for them to have this opportunity, and I think it's proving in the class that it is a wonderful opportunity for them. But I think there's some growth that has to occur, and I think we have to do that together. Again, the changing prison culture or changing the outcomes for these men grows at the speed of relationships, and those depend on trust. And I think that's what I've spent my last 7 or 8 months doing, both with the incarcerated men and the administration, is that they can trust that we understand the constraints they're under, their concern for safety and security, and they understand what we need as educators, and as well as this larger picture of men succeeding on the outside. And I think she's smart. The DSP, the deputy superintendent, understands this. And I think I'm really pleased at how they've gone to bat for us to have what we have so far.
I got to know, how did you sell this program, the criminology program?
Criminology class.
I mean, come on, it had to be a heck of a sell.
I just said, hey, we're teaching criminology next semester. Hope it would fly under the radar. And she's like, they review all of our textbooks,
sure,
so you can't just walk in. And she's like, well, let me take a look at the textbook. And she did. She took a week to review it and go through it. And I think a week is a long time to look through that book. Mm-hmm. And she gave it back and said, go for it. Yeah. And so there are officers who have questioned me, why are you teaching criminology? Is this going to make them better criminals? And gives me a chance to say, no, criminology is just about why people commit crime, not how to commit crime, not how to manipulate you as an officer, not how to get, it's about them to make sense of this big thing that they're part of. And we have a whole section on victimology in that class.
Victimology?
Yeah, where they have to look at the experiences of victims.
Mm.
And there are discussions of the trauma that victims go through after a criminal being the victim of a crime, particularly assaults of some kind. And the men took it pretty serious, and they reflected on it. And we kept to the textbook because I don't want to go too deep into their personal experience. Sometimes it's not the best place to do that in a classroom. We probably shouldn't. But you could see how they were affected by it, and how they had to make sense of it, and how they had to understand what their behavior had done to hurt other people and where they want to go in the future, because many of them want to get out and help people. Many of them want to be in the helping professions. They talk about wanting to do drug treatment. They want to be a peer educator or a peer support, and I'm hopeful that those opportunities are growing. As a matter of fact, in the prison education, the higher ed and prison program, there's an increasing number of people that are formerly incarcerated, including at our headquarters at SUNY.
Hmm.
So the SUNY Office of Higher Education and Prison, I think, has 2 or 3 people who are formerly incarcerated that are in assistant director positions. And so there's growing opportunity with that. And I think we're making those opportunities because we recognize the value of these people's experience.
Wow, that's got to be tremendously satisfying.
Yeah, and it's interesting to watch them too, because they'll bring some of that language from prison. Like I have to think about my idea of what's professional and their idea of what's professional, right, and we meet somewhere between, but I appreciate watching them be genuine and authentic with their voice about their experience, whereas I would have couched it in much more careful language.
Right.
Sometimes it's much more powerful to hear that directly from someone who's been through it.
And you must have grown to have a great appreciation then for the value of these men who are incarcerated,
uh-huh,
their experience, that, and the kind of, for lack of a better term, knowledge or social capital or whatever you want to call it, that they bring to life and to experience.
Yeah. And unfortunately, a lot of times when they're on the streets, those experiences are devalued or degraded or challenged,
sure,
in a way that they're not. But part of what we do in the classroom, too, is we give them the tools and the language to make sense and talk about their experience in ways that people don't dismiss. They're like, wow, I never thought of it that way, because now they have this language, whether it's sociological, whether it's from our English classes, teaching them how to just use the language in a way that's more persuasive. And so I think that that's one of the great values of this, too, is going back to this idea of cultural capital. They learn to express themselves in ways that's still true and authentic, but recognizes that the people on the outside need to hear it in a certain way so that they can be responsive to it.
It's fascinating. I mean, and we've seen a little bit on this program with some of the people that we've talked to, and most certainly have shared that, you know, very sense that they, you know, they know life from a certain standpoint.
Yep.
The other people don't have that, right?
No.
And it's very transferable.
It is. Yeah, it is. And many are feared they're going to be judged for it. But again, when they leave a program like ours and other programs, they begin to feel a certain confidence that, no, my experience is important. My experience is important. And while you could judge it, and I do judge myself, they'll talk about how they judge themselves sometimes harshly. They do think there's some great value and there's some incredible strength to get through, you know, an 8 or 12 year prison bid to come out. You'd be surprised. When I worked in Oregon State Department of Corrections, I was the reentry coordinator, so I helped guys before they hit released to the streets. And they had done, most of the men I had worked with had done 10 to 20, some 30 years. And we would take them out 2 weeks before the release date to get a tour of the free world. Mm. And we'd dress them in civvies. The officer would come with, dressed in civilian clothes. And we'd go have lunch and we'd go to grocery shopping or something. And you'd see guys who in prison are tough, who are intimidating, and they'd get in that grocery store for the first time in 30 years and they'd be holding onto the railing, shaking, terrified. Wow. And so there's that transition to the real world. Even when you've been especially successful in prison, things translate, but it's so terrifying at first for many of these men that to learn how that stuff is valuable, to learn how to translate the skills and the things they've learned in prison to the real world can be tricky.
And when you, like you said, that there's maybe a new language that they need to learn when it comes to self-defining. Is that something that you help them with, or do they find it on their own usually?
I mean, I see that depending on the class. I'm thinking in terms of the English class, Mr. B's English class. I think they learn that within the class.
Okay.
The class is specifically about writing different styles of writing, a persuasive essay, an essay that's scientific research or research-based or whatever. But each of those things gives them a new way of kind of expressing themselves. And then they learn language in my class. So they learn this concept, I keep going back to it, this idea of structure, meaning they're part of a system and they're acting within it. And that system affects the way they think about themselves and think about the world and their ability to interact in the world. And they begin to recognize that when they talk to people or when they experience other people, they can make sense of it through that lens. And it makes them, I think, much more flexible in dealing with the world. Whereas in prison, though, you don't have that same experience. So going back to your question, I think sometimes it's overt and we're talking to them, here's how you can express yourself.
Sure.
And other times it's like, let me give you a new perspective and some language and see what you can do with it.
Yeah, and you see the results.
By the end of the class, I do. I mean, I remember a class in Washington State, by the end of the gender class, and gender's a tough one to teach in prison, the men talked about, and I'm just going to use the word they used on their paper, the homoeroticism of the weight pile and working out. And I'm like, wow, I didn't teach that. But they recognized it, and they could talk about it safely in class. And prison's a hyper-masculine space, male prisons are. And so for them to kind of go there and use the language of a gender class was amazing to me. And that's, whatever you think of that particular thing, it showed the flexibility they were gaining in interacting with the world. Now, there are times in my class where men will say slurs against gay men, or they'll say things, and I'll just stop class and be like, are we working on our prison credibility, or are we working where we're going to be in the streets? Because on the streets, that's not going to fly.
Mm.
And they get it, and they're done.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you do have to have a little bit of a...
got to be aware of, like, hey, if you're going to say something that sounds racist, here's the consequences on the streets.
Right.
And they know it. They're not foolish.
Right.
But in prison, that's cool to talk that way. And I'm like, we're in this classroom, we're focused on the streets. So this is a sacred place. That doesn't happen here. And they get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're talking with Reed Helford, coordinator of the prison education program at Jamestown Community College. And we are here with What's Next at Jamestown Community College. As a matter of fact, you started off in higher academics, right?
Off as a sociology professor. I thought I was headed to Harvard or Yale or something like that. And in my first 2 months at this fairly privileged liberal arts college, I recognized these are not the students nor the place I think I want to be. I got a degree in sociology, a PhD in sociology, to help contribute to changing the world, and this just didn't feel
what,
right.
What felt odd about it? What felt off, would you say? Because it might be instructive into
I'm trying to think of how to put it in a way that's kind. I didn't feel like guaranteeing the privilege of already privileged kids was the best use of my time, if that makes sense.
No, it does make sense.
And
yeah.
So that environment didn't feel like academia to me. Again, I went to a somewhat activist, action research oriented in the community kind of place at Loyola University in Chicago. And this was much more of an academic space, and I realized I wasn't an academic in that way.
Mm.
And so I eventually left and went to a community college in Eastern Washington and taught there and got tenure there and stayed there for a while, and was considering leaving altogether when someone asked me to teach part-time in the prison. And like once I did that, I was hooked. I was done.
So you were perhaps ready to give up teaching sociology?
I was considering giving up academia, but trying to find how can I still be a sociologist in this world without necessarily being part of academia. And so when someone said, well, why don't you try teaching here? It's a little different experience. And so I did, and I realized that it fulfilled a lot of my desires. It was tough, a tough place to teach for a lot of reasons, but it tested my ability as a teacher. And you're immediately part of a community of folks committed to this prison work. And so eventually I was hired by the Department of Corrections in Washington and taken from the community college to do their programming, mostly in solitary confinement. And you're immediately connected to other people in the whole country who are doing this kind of work. And so when I did eventually leave it and come here to care for a parent, I spent 3 or 4 years outside of that work. And then when this came open, I jumped right back in that community. And I've been working with people like all over the country who love to talk about this, and we kind of push each other on what we're doing and how we're doing it. And so it's an exciting time right now. Things are blowing up because of Pell Grants. And I think it's drawing a lot of attention to how prisons work and how reentry works and how education can be part of that whole process.
So you're optimistic about this not just about your program, but the concept that, you know, maybe a generation from now, we're looking at a totally different prison system.
We could be. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, in some small way, we create the space. We have 2 classrooms right now in Collins. Those 2 classrooms, when we're in there, I think were the men feel to a certain extent outside of the prison, just for that time, because we're talking about things they don't talk about necessarily. We're hopeful long-term to create a whole dorm. These men live in dorm settings, not in cells. And we're hopeful long-term with the help of the prison to create a dorm just for men that are in the college program so we can create a culture of support amongst them, and they really want that. And so our hope is to grow to 40 or 50 students next fall, and then we perhaps can create that if the prison is willing to do it.
How did you have to adapt your teaching when you went from a community college into a prison?
I think I had to be a little more confident, but I had to be more flexible. I think that's the simplest way of putting
it.
I had to be much more open to things that I hadn't experienced in the free world teaching. And so challenges in ways that weren't by the textbook, challenges that were very personal or were based on some fundamental misunderstandings but were really instructive for the class. And so I had to be really flexible. I had to be able to work without a lot of bells and whistles. So I was used to taking little clips from YouTube and showing them as important. And now I have to find a way to express it to them or get them to do it. Sometimes we'll do role playing and they'll read stuff to each other based on something we've read, or I'll have them do the teaching. So in this class, in a couple of weeks, they'll all be doing the teaching for 2 weeks and they'll have to get up in front of class and do that.
Wow.
And so you've got to find ways that, given the constraints there, work in the classroom. And so I love that challenge. That's a constant challenge. And it brought back to me my love of teaching. I mean, not of love the publisher parish side of academia, but I love the challenge of teaching. And then I just feel really good about what we're doing. And when I hear these men succeed, like the one at the University of Rochester, I'm like, wow, we're doing something right.
And you also mentioned how you had to push aside some conceptions or pre-notions that you had. You probably can share that for yourself, but also maybe again for the the general public who's listening. This is something you don't understand about life in prison and the people who are in that prison.
I mean, in some ways, things are a lot more mundane and they're not that exciting. There are moments of violence. There are probably drugs. There are drugs in prison. The men that take our program have the lowest rate of infractions. Like, they don't do bad things in prison once they're in our program.
That's the case, yeah?
Yeah, it's absolutely the case. And so we're getting men who are ready to be done with that part of prison culture and who want to look forward to something different. And education is one of those routes to that. Could you repeat the question?
Preconceived notions people have about people.
So I came in with ones that were very much preconceived. I'll be really frank. I had some things I would now call racist expectations.
Could you explore that? That's interesting because I think that there's a lot of learning inside.
Absolutely. And I had men who would, to my face, teach me. And so when I first was in Washington, and I haven't had this experience in Collins, and I don't expect to, but in the prison, in the close custody or the higher custody levels in Washington State, gangs were clear who was in what gang, and they kept to those things, and those were racially defined often. And I would ask naive questions about it, and they would sit and talk to me. I'm Jewish, and I had a Jewish star in the back of my thing, and one of the gangs has a Jewish star as part of their symbols. They're not Jewish. And we would talk about it, and that was the entree into, he was being careful, right? And talking about gangs is frowned upon, but he made it clear, this is what it means to me. This is how it's portrayed in rap, and this is how it's portrayed on TV, but this is what it means to me, and this is how my family's been involved in the gang going back two generations, three generations. And so this is what it means to me. Some of the other gangs talked about uncles and brothers and parents and grandparents all being part of this gang. It was a very important part of their identity. In prison, it can be violent. In prison, it can be an unfortunate thing. But they taught me that it meant something to them that was really, really important. And I had to make space for that in my head. I had to make space for that in my head.
The conclusion for most is that you're in a gang and it's all about being violent and being a criminal.
Yep.
And it's not the case.
No. And so, again, I have to be very careful how I talk about it because, I mean, in prison, gangs are a threat to the functioning of the institution. But when men would talk about it both in class and to me privately, they expressed something a lot more nuanced than just running and gunning on the streets or selling drugs and stuff. It was about something that gave them purpose and identity. And while I'd rather their purpose and identity came from being a convict criminologist, like we said before,
right.
this is important to them at that moment. And there are many men who would come to me before they would leave and say, I'm going to try to go without it when I'm back in the streets. I'm going to try to be. And that was tough for them to let go of that, both with potential threats to themselves, but also because they were letting go of something really important to them, where they had a powerful identity on the streets. And now you want me to make $15 an hour getting my associate's degree on the streets and giving up all of that. And I'm like, yeah, I guess I am asking that if you're ready for it. And so I think when we have the two-dimensional characters of a convict or a gang member, we lose out on the complexity of their lives. It's a lot more complex than that. And it's something that I can't truly understand having not experienced it, but I can understand how important certain identities to me. I make sure students call me Dr. H or Dr. Helford. That's important to me. They recognize my educational accomplishment. And I'm not comparing that to gang identity, but I do recognize that all of us have these complex set of identities we maintain to feel okay in the world and feel comfortable and safe and that we have a place. And to demand that they pull that away, it's tough.
What was your specific field inside sociology?
So I was...
What was your interest?
Interestingly enough, sociology of knowledge and expertise. So how experts define the world for us and how we create truths in the world.
Wow.
And so I just studied it in practice, not in a philosophical sense.
Right.
And okay. So, yeah. So different than this, but it informs the way I think about the world.
Yeah.
It still does. How we construct truths and ideas about the world. And that certain folks' perspective are left out intentionally, so that they don't have the same ability to define the world. So when these people are previously incarcerated, have gone through the trauma of the justice system, and they're back on the streets, they should have a voice and help defining that for us so we understand what the truth of the criminal justice system is, not just the congresspeople writing the policy, right. but the folks who are subject to that policy should have a say in it.
Is that totally lacking right now?
I don't think so, but I think it's changing.
Okay.
And there's examples from the differential punishment for crack versus cocaine is a great example of how people had to address something that's clearly unjust and unfair. But I also think in education, too, how do you convince people that these men, many who've done unpleasant and maybe horrible things, how do we defend that they deserve an education in the world when many of the folks struggle to be able to pay for an education or didn't have that privilege themselves, and they see these men in prison getting that opportunity? And I think we have to talk about that and talk about both these men will be your neighbors eventually. They're almost all getting out. So would you rather have them prepared for the streets as a neighbor that is educated and ready to function in the world non-criminally? Or do you not want that? But I also think we have to talk about that everyone deserves that, and they themselves not having that privilege is a problem with the system as well. So it's not just these men. It's their experience, too, should be paid attention to. And so I think my men come out prepared to talk to people who might say they didn't deserve that education and do it in a way that's sensitive and understands why someone would say that to them.
It would be an interesting conversation.
Yeah, it would be interesting to watch.
Could you actually imagine it happening, though?
Yeah, I mean, I could see it happening already. We've talked about how they explained to some of their family members who are angry at them for what they did and who think you're in college now when that family member maybe had never had that opportunity. And so they talk about it. And I'm hopeful that we give them the tools to be able to do that gently and with grace, and so that they can bring these family members along.
Now we're coming down to our final few minutes here with, how about that? Yes, I looked at the clock. Now I know how many minutes we have left here with Dr. Reed Helford, coordinator of the prison education program at Jamestown Community College. So what, at Collins, what courses are available to them?
So this semester, we have a wide range of courses, and one of the things we try to encourage is to give them choice, to have at least one of the days a week where they can choose between a couple courses, because that educational choice is important. When we think about trauma-informed approaches to education, because many of these men have had considerable trauma in their life, we want to give them a sense of efficacy and control in their educational choices. So we offered a bunch this semester. We have math, we have English 2, our research-based writing class, we have environmental science class, we have criminology, we have business marketing.
And these are all college credit courses?
They're all college credit courses, yeah. We'll do a couple class in English and in math that's a support course, that's a pre-college level thing. We'll often have them take it either right before or at the same time as the other course to give them the support they need, particularly in writing and in math.
Right.
We also have a history course this semester.
Okay.
So it's a broad range of courses. It's a social science degree, but within that we have some room to do things. So we're hoping this summer to do creative things. So to give them a chance to take a couple classes in either creative writing, we're asking one of our acting teachers to consider teaching an acting class, and maybe we'll do some Shakespeare this summer, or a drawing class.
Wow.
And so we want to give them that range. We want to have that true liberal arts experience for them.
Homework given to the students?
Homework's given to them. They take their books back with them. We bought them folders that they can carry all their stuff in, and they go back and forth with that. They'll work together sometimes. Oftentimes I'll use class time for them to work together because they can't otherwise work together. But yeah, plenty of homework.
And always, they're not like me in high school, they actually come back with their homework?
95%. Yeah? Okay, in my class, 100% are doing their homework.
100%?
Yeah, better than I was. Because, I mean, you could say, what else do they have to do? But they do have other things that are trying to get
their time. I never had anything else to do in high school. I didn't do my homework.
Good point. Yeah. Thank you. That's a good point. I think that their commitment to the program is really clear. They recognize what they have. This is a privilege, and they appreciate it. And I remind them, this is a sacred place. When you walk into this classroom, the politics of the prison are gone. The language we might use out there, this is a college classroom, but for me, it's a sacred place. And they're committed to that. I think in all of our classes, and the professors expect that from them. But I think every professor that we have, and you could talk to any of the ones we have now, they would all tell you these are some of the best students they've ever worked with, because they get out of that class and they go back to their dorm and they're studying right away. And they want to succeed. And grades are really important.
Oh, okay.
Grades aren't important to me, but to them they are, and I learned really quick. Another thing I learned to adjust to is I would be very flippant about grades and say that they're not a measure of whatever, and they're like, no, Dr. H, they're a measure of my success. I never got A's. I'm getting A's this time.
Wow.
I'm like, all right.
Well, I want to thank the folks at Jamestown Community College for giving us the space to bring What's Next here today, and of course for giving us a chance to talk to Dr. Helford. Also, I want to thank, I guess we need to thank the folks at Collins Correctional Facility as well for what they're doing. But Dr. Reed Helford, thanks for being with us on What's Next.
Thank you so much.